Good morning. We'll go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here bright and early, bushy-tail on a Monday. We do not have any work session for possible introduction of committee bills. What we're going to do is start in with our informational hearing on municipal courts and justice of the peace. We have the privilege of having Judge Myers and Judge Limhouse here. So, Jed and Carl, why don't y'all come on up? And it says maybe it's some other presenters. Do we have others? Okay. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for being here on
a
wet, windy day.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carl Myers. I am the municipal court judge in the city of Kaiser, the city of Jefferson. But you'll be seeing me on a different capacity most of this session because I represent the municipal court judges and the justices of the peace judges in this process. And we do have some bills that that will be in front of you throughout the session. But we wanted to take a few minutes of your time to acquaint you with what I call the local courts. Those are the justice of the peace courts and the municipal courts. I believe earlier you heard from the Chief Justice about the state courts, but now you get to hear the rest of the story. I need to ask, how many of you have justice courts in your district? Yeah. And how many of you have municipal courts in your district? I should see all hands, but the same one. Multnomah County doesn't have a municipal court at this point because all that's done by the circuit court in Multnomah County, but I understand that Gresham may be looking to add a municipal court, so there may be finally one in Multnomah County. And then probably my last question is, how many of you have voluntarily visited a municipal court or a justice court?
Voluntarily.
Voluntarily.
If you work, is that voluntary?
Probably not. We'll give you a pass on that, Senator.
All right.
Anyway, I call them local courts because there really isn't a better term. At one point, these used to be called specialty courts or special courts, but that term is now used by mental health courts, drug courts, veterans courts, and some of the other specialty courts. They are called by some limited jurisdiction courts. I don't like that term. So I call them local courts because, in fact, they are local, they're funded locally, et cetera. But I want you to know, and I'll say it again at the end, these are very important courts to the system of justice. They take cases that the circuit courts would take but don't really have the time to take, don't particularly enjoy taking. We can do the jobs that we do much less expensive, much faster, and in many cases better than the circuit courts do simply because of our position and our training and our involvement. With that, Judge Limhouse will tell you a little bit about the justice courts and how they operate.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jed Limhouse, Justice of the Peace for Linn County. As Justice of the Peace, I also exercise municipal court jurisdiction for 8 cities within Linn County, 2 of which have freestanding municipal courts. The other 6 have assigned their municipal court jurisdiction to the Justice of the Peace Court. So, as Judge Myers indicated, we are local courts. We handle local problems. The Office of Justice of the Peace is an ancient one, and in fact, it's the longest standing, continuously serving judicial branch in the state of Oregon. The Justices of the Peace initially came to Oregon as a result of an act of Parliament when the Oregon country was jointly administered by both the great countries of Great Britain and the United States. Between 1818 and 1846, the Oregon country, as it was known from the Alaska border to the California border, north to south, and from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific coast, east to west, was jointly administered. Sometime in the 1830s, a group of Methodist missionaries appointed the first Justice of the Peace under American auspices. These justices of the peace who were then serving were also recognized by the provisional government that was formed in the 1840s, and the first statutes passed by the territorial legislature in 1847 required that there be a justice of the peace in every precinct in the state of Oregon, or I should say in the territory of Oregon. Oregon statutes were enacted. The first statutes contained essentially the same language. A justice of the peace was to be elected or appointed in each precinct within the state. So there's a long history of justice of the peace serving in Oregon. Justices of the peace are constitutional judges in the same sense that circuit court judges are. Justice courts are operated by counties, were considered to be a county elected official, and by intergovernmental agreements between cities and counties, the justices of the peace may also act as municipal judges or exercise municipal court jurisdiction, as I do in both instances. So in a sense, I wear three different hats, although I'm a single judge. The constitutional basis for justice of the peace courts is Article 7 of the Oregon Constitution, the same provision of the Oregon Constitution that deals with circuit courts and the appellate courts and the tax court. Although we're a state judicial officer, we're also a county elected official because we serve a six-year term, and we're elected by the electors in our Justice of the Peace District. Justices of the Peace Districts cannot include the county seat of any county except for one county in Western Oregon, Tillamook County, and seven counties in Eastern Oregon. We do not sit in any count, any city where the circuit court holds regular sessions except for those eight of the 36 Oregon counties. For the most part, we're rural courts. In the documents that you have on your desk at the bottom of the stack is a listing of all the justices of the peace who serve presently in the state of Oregon. There are 24 of us. 11 of us are lawyers, 13 are lay judges. The 13 lay judges are 10 women and 3 men. The 11 lawyer judges are 3 women and 8 men. And so there's a, as you probably will notice, the Justice of the Peace bench is pretty much balanced between male and female judges. Counties have the authority when they create Justice of the Peace districts to require that the Justice of the Peace be a member of the Oregon State Bar, but that is otherwise not a statutory or constitutional requirement for holding the office. Justice of the Peace have jurisdiction over all offenses that occur within the county in which they are situated, except for the trial of felonies. They also have civil jurisdiction for matters where the recovery of damages or personal property that does not exceed $10,000 in value, which means that we do a lot of small claims. We also have our jurisdiction over landlord-tenant actions, and so Justice of the Peace Courts also do a lot of landlord-tenant actions. Do I have any questions so far about anything? Have I not caused some somnolence on anybody's part? Or there's a little bit of a distinction between justice of the peace and municipal courts. The municipal courts are basically created by the charter and ordinances of a city. When cities were chartered before the Home Rule Amendment was enacted in, I believe, 1906, the legislature chartered cities by a special act of the legislature. Those legislative acts granted to an officer of the city, generally the recorder, all the powers, duties, and jurisdiction of a justice of the peace for the county in which the city was located. And so that is essentially the genesis of municipal courts in Oregon. They originally started out as recorder's courts. When the Home Rule Amendment was enacted, then many of the cities rechartered themselves and assigned their judicial jurisdiction to a municipal court judge. And so now we have municipal courts that handle basically, for the most part, just criminal actions, misdemeanor crimes, and violation offenses of any description, plus the violations of the charter and ordinances of any city. Municipal judges are not subject to They're not Article 7 judges, as are justices of the peace. They are, however, judicial officers, as that term is defined by statute, and they have the same power to issue warrants of arrest for persons who have committed crimes as do circuit court judges and justices of the peace. That's just a kind of a general thumbnail sketch of what we do. Jurisdiction that is handled by justice of the peace courts and municipal courts is essentially the broadest jurisdiction. We're called limited jurisdiction or special courts, but the types of actions that we deal are actually the most common. And so municipal courts and justice courts together, probably outside of Multnomah County, handle the biggest part of the misdemeanor crimes that are charged and the largest part of the violation offenses that are charged. And in rural areas, they typically handle most of the small claim and forcible entry and detainer landlord-tenant actions as well. So they're an essential ingredient and constituent part of the criminal justice system and the general justice system, both civil and criminal, throughout the state of Oregon. There are a few counties like Multnomah County that have either limited cities or have the cities that exist in those counties have not constituted municipal courts. An example is the Josephine County. There are two incorporated cities in Josephine County. One is Grants Pass and the other is Cave Junction. Cave Junction has a municipal court, but Grants Pass does not. And it's the county seat and it's the largest city in the county by quite a measure. I believe Jefferson County from time to time has the county seat at Madras has had a municipal court, but it just kind of comes in and goes out. It depends on, I don't know what it depends on, but from time to time the circuit court gets to take the whole load, and other times the city has a municipal court that takes a good part of the load as well. The situation that works best probably in my estimation is where you have actually all three circuit justice and municipal courts working together in a single county. The circuit court basically has whether you wish to consider this or not, the unfortunate duty of handling all the ugly stuff, all the felony crimes and the large value civil actions, property disputes between neighbors involving the title to real property, all those kinds of things are dealt with by the circuit court. They all take a lot of time and they take an awful lot of the judge's attention. The advantage of having justice and municipal courts handling the lesser value cases and the less serious criminal actions is that the circuit courts don't have to deal with it. You don't have to pay for it. The state of Oregon doesn't have to pay to adjudicate those cases. The cities and the counties take care of that. And at the same time, they're paying you substantially sums of money. One of the things that I included in the summaries that I prepared for you is the amount of money that the justice and the municipal courts have each paid into the criminal fine account so far in the present biennium. And in total, it's around $22 or $23 million, is my recollection. That's an appreciable sum, and it's all coming from small actions.
Yes, I just wanted to add a couple of things, again, for the record, Carl Myers. I just wanted to add a couple of things to what Judge Lemhouse said about municipal courts. First of all but four municipal court judges serve at the pleasure of the council in the city in which they serve. Four cities, West Lynn, Ashland, Hermiston, and the city of Salem have elected judges, but that is they are in a distinct minority. The requirements for a judge are set by the city charter. We need not be members of the Oregon State Bar, but in almost all large cities, there is some charter requirement that they be members of the bar. It is in districts or in areas where it's difficult to get lawyers to serve, that may not be required by the city. Most of us are not courts of record, which would mean that a trial in a municipal court can then be appealed to have a new trial in circuit court. Those appeals don't happen very often, but that is an extra layer of protection people can have an appeal. As Jad pointed out, there are some advantages to both municipal and justice courts over circuit courts. He mentioned the fact that that it doesn't cost the state any money to run these courts, but we do put in money into the state general fund and other specified funds for the use by the state, and to some extent the circuit courts. In most cases, we are more convenient to the parties because we're closer to where they are. We're closer, quite frankly, to where the police stations are, so the police don't have to drive 50 miles to have a case called off at the last minute. In my court in Kaiser, the officers are off duty for about 10, 15 minutes while I handle the case, and then they're back on the street. If they were to go down to a circuit court in Marion County, they may be down there all morning, if not all day, just for a simple traffic matter. Many of the courts, justice courts and municipal courts, meet in the evening. So they are more convenient to the users. The citizens get to stay closer to home. Typically, we can set our trials quicker. They last far less time than they would maybe in a circuit court, at least in overall time from when the appearance is to start as to when the trial would be over. Generally, there's less waiting time. I schedule my cases generally a month or two out. That's the max. I don't like to have them hanging around. So we can get justice much quicker. I would say all justice courts and municipal courts are able to to operate with much less overhead. Most of the judges are part-times. The salaries that are set by the county or the city are much less. Some judges... most judges don't get any kind of health benefit, are not eligible or subject to PERS. The clerks are paid less typically than at the state, so we can handle the matters that we handle much less expensively, much quicker, and in a more hands-on manner, which most of our clients, our customers, don't have attorneys. We're able to spend some time with them. And because we are the courts that these people will probably only see in their lifetime, we set the tone for the judicial system because that is, again, their only interface. So when we get to spend some more time with them, kind of explain our decisions, maybe hear some what they want to gripe about, and not be worried necessarily about our docket or the rules of evidence. We can have them allow them to vent and speak their piece. They go away, even if they lose, much better satisfied that they had their chance. Because we do some hand-holding. We have to have some patience, understanding, and in many cases our job is not necessarily to convict but to educate and to make sure that people don't reoffend, whether it be a traffic law or a municipal ordinance violation of that sort. That being said, any questions of the committee?
Just a quick question.
Sure.
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to this, but I don't remember seeing judges for these particular courts, municipal or judicial courts, on the ballot. Are you appointed? I didn't catch that if you said it. So are they appointed, or do you run, or how does that happen?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Thatcher, justices of the peace are elected.
Okay.
They do get appointed by the governor at it if there is an opening, but they do run for election at the next time. You don't see them. They tend to be at the end of the ballot and are often unopposed. As I said, most municipal court judges are not elected. City does. If you live in the city of Salem, you'll get a ballot with the judge position, whether it's opposed or not. But there's only four of those. The rest of us serve at the pleasure of the council, which means that I could be out tomorrow if the council doesn't. Well, they have to give me 30 days notice by my contract, but essentially I could be out tomorrow if they didn't like the tie that I wore that particular day. So there is some... all of the judges in this state are subject to the electorate, either directly or indirectly.
Yep. Any other questions? Anything else?
All right, well, I appreciate the overview.
The last thing I want to say, Senator, is, again, we will be having some bills in front of you, but there will be other bills that will come up that will have an impact on the local courts. And the reason that we wanted to do this presentation is to make sure that you understand that there is another level of courts out there that are as important as the circuit courts, that do very good work for you and the state, and that you should consider us in your deliberation on other bills that may have an impact on your local community. Thank you.
I have a question, though, before you leave.
Oh.
So what we've done in Florence, I've actually imposed the guidelines to bring felony cases into our court by reducing them to an attempt for a Class A misdemeanor so they get the jurisdiction. I'm wondering if y'all could tell me if other courts are doing that. And, of course, the reason why we're doing it is because our circuit court is so backed up. Actually, the district attorney's office, many cases such as simple possession of methamphetamines are not being prosecuted at that level. They have I don't remember what the current number is, but over 100 and something charges that they are not bringing forward just because of limitations on resources. So could you all comment on as to how the JP courts and the municipal courts, from your understanding, have tried to fill that void, if they have?
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, if I could answer that question briefly. Because we handled municipal court misdemeanor jurisdiction, what you suggested is a relatively, it becoming a more common solution. I know that the city of Junction City has been experiencing the same problems as the city of Florence and Lane County. They're just across the river from where one of my justice courts is located, so I'm somewhat familiar with what they do. And they've been charging these low-level drug offenses as a misdemeanor, attempted possession, and they've been doing that for several years. It's worked very well. They have a small jail facility that holds something around 6 or 8 prisoners, and they're able to lodge persons who are convicted. It's a relatively short period of time. They can only hold them for about 14 days before they have to be released. But in many cases, there is at least a sanction, whereas the situation that you described, if the district attorney is not going to prosecute those actions, there's not going to be a sanction. In Lynn County, we haven't got to that point yet. The district attorney's office is still prosecuting most crimes, most drug offenses. The district attorney's office in Lynn County, however, does not prosecute all property crimes. And so those are the offenses. Actually, the quality of life offenses, those are the things that are handled in justice in the peace courts and municipal courts. If you look at one of the documents that I gave you that has a list of the criminal cases handled by a justice of the peace court, you'll notice that the Lynn County Justice of the Court, that's me, handles more crimes than any other justice of the peace court in the state of Oregon. That's because the sheriff's deputies file actions in the justice of the peace court, and so do the troopers. I handle most of the fishing wildlife offenses. We don't do a lot of fishing cases, but we do a lot of big game cases in the justice court, and most of those are prosecuted as crimes. And without an awful lot of expense to the state of Oregon, but we resolve most of those cases in a fairly quick manner. Rarely do we go more than about, I would say, probably 2 or 3 months from the date of the first appearance until we have a resolution on those cases. Usually it's about 6 to 8 weeks if they plead out at a pretrial conference, which is normally the case. Rarely do we have to go any further than that. The municipal courts and justice court in Lynn County handle about 60% of all the crimes that are filed in the county. I'm not sure what the percentage in Lane County is, but my guess is it's probably even greater in Lane County. Most of the counties in western Oregon rely primarily upon justice and municipal courts to resolve these lesser offenses, misdemeanor offenses. And now, as Senator Przanski pointed out, they're also handling matters that would be charged as felonies where the resources available to so charge them. Those resources are not available at the state level, and so they're moving back to the local level, which means that the cities and counties are having to pick up the tab for that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
So that's going to conclude our informational meeting and hearing on the Municipal Courts and Justice of the Peace Courts. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 342. Chana?
Certainly, Chair Fusansky, members of the committee. This is your revisor's bill. Every long session, Legislative Council introduces a bill that makes non-substantive, corrective, and technical changes to the ORSs. This bill is ready to move today. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact issued.
All right, thank you. Ted, I guess you drew the short straw for LC today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm Ted Reutlinger, the Chief Deputy Legislative Counsel. It is my honor every session to prepare the revisor's bill, which is one of the most exciting bills you'll visit this session, but it's also an important bill. It's a routine bill that we do each session. The main goal of this bill is simply to correct errors, omissions, and update references in the Oregon revised statutes. As hard as we try to make every bill absolutely perfect, errors do creep into the statutes, and we correct them in this bill each session. We remove obsolete provisions, we update language, we conform to legislative form and style, which you adopt by rule in the Senate. The other main goal of this bill is not to make any substantive changes in the law. You can see that the title to this bill is relating to correction of erroneous material in Oregon law. That's a very narrow title and will not allow you to make any substantive changes in this bill. Secondly, Section 1 of the bill makes it clear that nothing in this chapter is intended, in this bill, is intended to alter the legislative intent or purpose of the statutory sections that we amend. So the bill does not make any substantive changes other than to fix errors. Finally, each section of this bill is reviewed by an attorney in our office with subject matter responsibility to make sure that we've made the correct correction and that we have not made any substantive changes. So in a nutshell, that's what the revisor's bill is. It also is unique because at the end of each section, there's a little note that tells you exactly what we have corrected in that section so you can tell what's happening. That's all I have. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
All right. Any questions for Ted?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, man. It's Monday morning.
I have a question.
All right. Excellent. Senator Cruz.
Okay. Section 56, page 41. I think the point is sometimes the preferred language changes. We've seen that before because this one, it changes no person shall to a person may not. And so we shall and may have been interchangeable and changed back and forth from time to time. So I guess this is just bringing that to the flavor of the month, more or less. So.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Cruz, yes, that is the preferred form of drafting these days. We try to keep our drafting current with modern usage. And as you know, there are lots of really antiquated provisions in the statutes. When we get a chance to simply make a form and style change like this, we take advantage of it.
Yeah. Words have meaning, and the use of may and shall have been interesting over the last few years as we've evolved. So,
yeah, it has. Any other riveting questions?
I had that one.
I know. Okay. I just see if there's any others. All right, Ted, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 342? Not seeing one rushing up here. I'm assuming not, so we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 342.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 342 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 342 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Oh, that they're all this easy.
This is to a degree a trust me bill, but I think.
Yeah,
the track record is very good on this bill over the course of time. So,
all right. Any other questions or? All right. No comments. No others. We'll go ahead and pass the bill on the motion that's been made. Now the decision. who should carry it? I actually am thinking, Senator Cruz, that maybe we should have a joint carriers on this one. What do you think?
Well, I would think it's, you know.
Okay. Senator Thatcher and Senator Gelser, y'all would be the carriers on Senate Bill 342.
Open and close. Yeah, you know,
thank
that's
you very
cool.
much for y'all's service.
Got to be some Mickey Hazy from time to time, okay?
And do it together as freshmen, you know. All right, so now we've closed the work session on Senate Bill 342. We'll open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 471.
Chair Pazansky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 471 comes to you from Senator Dembro, Senator Montes Anderson, and Senator Cruz. This measure currently has no amendments. We are still waiting for the fiscal impact statement to come back in on it, so I don't think it's going to be ready to move today. This bill deals with guardianship proceedings and allows the appointment in of counsel to protected persons in certain circumstances.
All right. I saw Senator Dembro come in. So, Senator Dembro, why don't you start off? Do you have anyone else that you want to bring to the dais? We have a number of people we're going to be calling up.
I'll just introduce the bill, then I have to run back to
okay.
the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 471 deals with an issue that some of you have heard before, but now actually I'm looking, it's just the chair and Senator Cruz who were with us last year. We had an informational hearing during the interim on this issue, and it's something that has been known to a lot of people for quite a while. It became known to me through my work on the Public Guardianship Task Force, which was created in 2009, came out of the Human Services Committee on the House side, and created a task force to work on the problem of that so many people around the state who need guardianship services don't have access to them because they have no family, they have no income, they're indigent in many cases. And it led to ultimately, finally, during the short session of 2014, to the creation of our new public guardianship program within the long-term care ombudsman program. And as I understand it, that program is actually just now this month or last month getting underway. So it's a great and wonderful thing. The task force included people working in all areas of dealing with protected persons. It was chaired by a former judge, the estimable Elizabeth Betsy Welch, whom you'll be hearing from in just a moment. People from Disability Rights Oregon, people from the various agencies, local government, attorneys, district attorneys, and One of the issues that surfaced through it was, okay, I think we all agreed that there was a strong need to have a program that would allow people who needed it to get into a guardianship situation. But it, as I think everyone knows, guardianship is a very serious infringement on one's civil liberties, one's civil rights. You know, this is not something that needs to that should be taken lightly. And one would expect that if a guardianship decision is going to be made, there would be a hearing and the potentially protected person would be represented by counsel. And in many, if not most states, that is the case, but it's not the case here in Oregon. And This was something that came up as kind of on the back burner for bringing forward. Last year, Senator Montes Anderson had a constituent who that she had heard from who had gotten into guardianship, he felt, and never really understood that had happened to him until it had happened to him. And, he was wondering to Senator Montes Anderson, well, you know, why didn't I get my day in court about this? And so that's essentially what this bill is about. As I understand, you'll be hearing from the experts. People in this situation do have a right to a hearing if they request it. But as you know, very often people who are in a potentially guardianship situation are not really in a position to, you know, to know their rights, that to know that they need to request a hearing. So this would make such a thing more automatic. That, in a nutshell, is what the bill is, and it will, you know, I think you'll hear both the details of its importance and just more of how such a thing would work from the various experts that will be following me.
Great. Any questions, Senator Cruz?
Probably just a comment. I've been working on the other end of the spectrum with dependency for a long time on representation. I just wanted to thank Senator Dembro for educating me and on this and the work we have done together to bring this forward. I think this is absolutely an essential step to be, for us to take. So thank you for your leadership.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. All right. Senator Gelser, you were looking at me, so did you?
I have a question.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I just want to make sure. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Dembro, for bringing this bill and for all of your work on the guardianship. Have you had any discussions in that guardianship task force about people on the very young end of the spectrum that are moving into guardianship? Many families that have individuals, children with intellectual and developmental disabilities, find they need to move for a guardianship that's in effect when the child turns 18 or the adult turns 18 so that they can participate in medical decisions and continue to receive information from school. When we went through this process with our son, I was alarmed at how vulnerable he was in that process because no court visitor was required as his parent at that time, and the person that was applying for guardianship, I was the person that would explain to him what was happening. I would be the person that would tell him he had the right to request a hearing, and we had to request that a court visitor come and talk with him. Have you talked at all about that very early end in the vulnerability of people going from minors and never having the opportunity to have their rights?
Chair Przanski, Senator Gelser, we didn't discuss that explicitly as part of the task force, but subsequent to the work of the task force, there's a new group that has formed called the WINGS group, which brings together people from all over the spectrum who are dealing with a variety of guardianship issues. And I think that they have been discussing that. In any case, Fred Steele from DHS, who's been leading that effort, is going to be testifying. So he can tell you more about that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the senator? All right, well, thank you very much.
All right, back to the mines.
There you go. All right, I have, it looks like, five individuals that are possibly wanting to testify. What I'm going to do is bring up a first panel, Bob Junduff and Jonathan
Bartholomew.
Why don't y'all two come up, and then I've got another set of, I think, three that may want to testify.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I'm very happy to be here to testify in support of Senate Bill 471. The WINGS group that you just heard referred to is a body that one of our staff attorneys at DRO, Jan Friedman, has been sitting on, and DRO has been involved in guardianship issues as long as I've been there, which gets us back to the 80s. In a nutshell, and I'm actually not here to present the bill, so I just want to present our particular slant on it. Disability Rights Oregon first came to you on guardianship matters back in 1991 as the result of cases we had seen in which people had guardians appointed for them without the benefit of notice, counsel, or hearing. And that began a process of working with a variety of stakeholders in order to change our legal structure to provide that there was that people would be entitled to a hearing if they requested one, and people had the right to counsel, although there was no financing for counsel if they were indigent. And the idea behind this is basically that guardianship is creates a massive intrusion in individual rights. It is oftentimes, if not most of the time, lifelong. And there are impediments to, once a guardianship is put in place, to having that guardianship either dissolved or having a guardian, the identity of the guardian changed. In other words, having a person substituted. Those types of actions all require courts to become involved and take time to address the issue, and that oftentimes involves not only hearings, but lawyers who are representing the guardian or other interested parties. And therein lies the rub, is that while guardianship exists in order to protect people who need additional protection, it's a very expensive process for many of the people involved. And oftentimes there isn't the expertise or understanding across the board in terms of how it affects people's rights. And there lies the need for expert advice, consultation, and an ability to take action in a judicial forum on behalf of a person who may be subject to a guardianship, may have disputes or concerns about whether that they need a guardian or not, and whether the person who could potentially be the guardian is the right person. And those are generally the issues that come forward in a guardianship proceeding. As you might imagine, oftentimes when a person receives notice that a guardianship is pending, they're not at their best. They may have some disorganized thinking. They may have better days and worse days. But also, unfortunately, there are times in which a person may be unduly influenced at that particular moment by someone who's concerned with their affairs and may not necessarily have their best interests at heart. The best way to handle these types of complications is to make sure that a matter comes before a court, a disinterested decision maker who can weigh all of the factors and make a reasonable decision. But if the affected person is unable to organize their information, contact witnesses, and bring them to the attention of the court, that fair and balanced type of decision making may not occur. Senate Bill 471, I think, is a pretty balanced approach to the problem in that it does not. It could go further. It could require there to be hearings for every single guardianship that's filed. It could require counsel in every guardianship that is filed. It does not do that. It is narrowly tailored to require an appointment of counsel when an indigent individual asks for counsel. Not a disinterested court visitor informs the court that counsel might be necessary. If the court itself recognizes that counsel might be necessary to protect that person's important rights. And so we feel that this is, it's not going all the way. It's a pretty balanced approach. And it recognizes the fact that guardianships can be expensive, that expense can be a barrier for families that are just trying to get some protections in place. So we feel that this is a very good balanced approach, and we urge its passage.
Thank you very much. John?
All right. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I am the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. And I provided some written testimony, so I don't need to rehash it. I think that the two speakers before me eloquently stated the reasons and rationale for this legislation. But I just wanted to share that before taking this position, I was involved with the Alzheimer's Association. And in that role, as part of the estate plan for Alzheimer's Disease Task Force, we, along with AARP and a number of other stakeholders, did town hall meetings all across the state, including Roseburg and Albany and Portland and Pendleton and Bend. All across the state, we regularly heard concerns about guardianships and people who had been appointed guardians that then took advantage of them. And that's one of the reasons that we feel that this legislation is so necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, in this WINGS group, have you all had any conversation about what it would take for Oregon to move to more of a supported decision-making model instead of guardianships?
Chair Przanski, Senator Gelzer, assisted decision-making is sort of on the cutting edge right now of how to address people whose ability to make decisions for themselves is limited. And it has a couple of premises about it. It is that virtually everyone has some ability to make some level of decisions, and that if that ability can be encouraged and worked with, that a person can have the best decisions made for them. Our existing guardianship statutes actually have provisions in place that encourage this type of assisted decision making. It doesn't use that particular phrase, but in fact, it specifically says a guardian should involve the protected person in all decisions and try to come to a decision that is most in line with what their desires are. And so I think there was some forward thinking on this topic many years ago here in Oregon. Another positive factor is that while many states rely much more upon guardianship than we do here in Oregon, Oregon has less use of the guardianship proceedings, I think, one thing because of cost, but also because there's a recognition that people can get services that they need, can get the supports that they need without the intervention of a guardian. So while I think that is something that has been talked about, we've actually have a pretty good record here in Oregon on that score.
Thank you.
Any other?
I guess I just have sure. I don't know if we're going to be hearing from other people or opponents or anybody.
They're not on the list, but I got their names. I'm going to see if they want to come up.
So. Well, I guess I just wanted to get Everybody that passes a bill, there's always a downside to every bill. I'm just wondering what would be the downside. I mean, is it just merely the expense for an occasional appointment of an attorney? Or
Senator Thatcher, Chair Przanski, I think that's exactly right.
Okay. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I have three other names. They aren't actually on the witness registration, but they were given to me. Judge Welch, Fred Steele, and Nancy Cosine. I'm not sure if any of you want to testify. Please come up if you do. And while they're coming up, I'm just going to see if anyone else was going to raise their hand as to who may want to testify afterwards. Okay. And ma'am, why don't you go ahead and come on up? I don't have your name, and we'll just get on the record when you come up. Good morning. So whoever would like to get started.
I'd like to. Good morning, Chairman Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Elizabeth Welch, a retired Multnomah County Circuit Court judge, and kind of I've been involved in the public guardian process since it started. I was the chair of the task force, both of the interims that we flailed away at this and spent a lot of time in this building. This is kind of coming up in a backwards sort of way. The Public Guardian Task Force was created to address that issue. One of the concerns that I had and other members of our task force had from the beginning is our due process considerations, right to hearing and right to counsel. The problem was that our charge was to deal with this, and the issue of counsel and hearings is a broader issue because not everybody who is the subject of a potential guardianship proceeding would even be considered to be in the narrower population of a public guardian. These are the very most indigent and friendless element. So there was resistance within our group to trying to address the broader issue when our charge was only for the public guardian. For instance, it would be very hard for me to come in here and say that only people who are the subject of a public guardian petition should get a lawyer, but not other people who are the subject of a guardianship proceeding. It would stick in my throat as a lawyer and as a judge. It just doesn't make any sense. So we come another chapter later and saying to you, there are some very significant problems with the quality of the process of guardianship in this state. And this is a very, very big one, not the only one. But a very, very big one. Under current Oregon law, respondents in an adult guardianship proceeding, that is the people who are the subject of the petition respondents, have the right to be represented. And that means they can get a lawyer. They can get a lawyer, or someone can get one for them. There is no authority to grant publicly supported counsel, you know, paid counsel, in this state, period. For those of you who are lawyers, you'll appreciate this right away, but I think the others will as well, that a petition for civil commitment, which is deals with very similar issues sometimes, it automatically results in the appointment of counsel without question, without being asked for it. They get lawyers. Why is that? How can this strange situation exist? And the answer is civil proceedings are brought in the name of the state, and therefore the cases fall kind of into that basket of the state is imposing something on somebody. Guardianship proceedings are, generally speaking, brought by individual members of a family or whatever. So it's more of a private, we can call it a private proceeding. Nationally, 47 states have provisions for state payment of counsel for people that we're talking about. Some of them are mandatory, as Mr. Joondiff mentioned. That's an approach. Everybody who's the subject of such a petition gets a lawyer, period. And that's a very large number of the states. Actually, the larger number it's mandatory. And then there's something that's kind of like what is in the bill before you, that is more discretionary. And one of the things that deals with is there are people who simply do not have the capacity to communicate at all. They don't have an opinion about whether they want to have a guardian. They are not able to express themselves at all. I mean, people who are very, very disabled by whatever cause. So the idea that there should be a lawyer for everybody without regard to their circumstances was something that's where the balance was struck, although there are probably some other arguments why it shouldn't be across the board for everybody. Just to rub it in a little bit, the only states other than Oregon that do not provide for counsel are Arkansas, Mississippi, and Delaware, for your information. The people we're talking about are the prime targets in any community for elder abuse. And the elder abuse, unfortunately, comes in terms of volume mainly from their own families. And frequently, the petitioner in a guardianship is the bad guy who wants to finally get complete control of mama's money or whatever the motives may be, and they can be very complicated. Having been in the juvenile field and domestic relations for many, many years before I became the probate judge in Portland, this stuff makes domestic relations look respectable. I mean, it is so nasty, and the family dysfunction levels are so awful. It's just a never-ending, bizarre experience to hear another story about another family that just disintegrates, or maybe always was disintegrated, when someone becomes ill or has other problems. What does a lawyer do to represent somebody like this is, I think, perhaps the biggest question you might have. And, you know, what is the lawyer's job? And that a lot of very obvious things. Just if you can, if they have an opinion, if they have wishes, they should be represented and considered. But there are two really important elements of representation of these folks. Number one is the amount of intervention that's necessary, that there be some kind of looking at. Now, maybe you need to have a guardian that can do this and this and this, but not some other things. The intervention needs to take into consideration the person's needs and their capacities. And this is the only person in the system that's going to be advocating for the least restrictive alternative. That's the terminology. And the other issue is the reality of litigation. And in litigation, in my experience, and it's extensive in more than one county, the issue in a contested guardianship is not whether there should be a guardianship. Not in my, it is so hard to do this for people, to bring a guardianship against, you know, for their parent, their spouse, their child. It's very hard, it's very expensive, and there are a lot of pretty good screens. The court visitor program is a very good program and a very necessary part of the integrity of the program. The issue is who's going to be the guardian. And those are the big fights. And you can see how having an attorney who gets into the family dynamics or whatever the dynamics are, figures out what's going on here and who's doing what, can be absolutely invaluable to the process of determining who should do this. Having an example of the kind of things that guardians who are misbehaving do is blocking contact between siblings. In other words, we're generally speaking, the petitioners in these kind of cases are about 60 years old. Mama's about 80 or 85 or 90. And the question is, who's in charge? Which sister, which brother gets to be call the shots? And these fights have lifetime issues, you know, simmering away in them. So these are really messy, messy situations where the individual needs to have someone that speaks for them and acts to the best degree they can. But I can't be still until I talk a little bit about the Public Guardian Program. I am on the advisory committee to the long-term care ombudsman. It's now called the Residential Facilities Advisory Committee, and I am there for the purpose of being sort of the midwife of this effort. And we do finally have someone we've hired. He's been on the job almost exactly a month, and he's working very hard, and we hope, you know, to be moving along quickly. The integrity of that effort, because in a way it is the state that is the moving party in those guardianships. The integrity of that process hangs very much on there being representation for the individual. If you want, I don't want to take more of your time than you need me to take. The question is, how did we get away with this for so long of not having lawyers for these folks? And I've read some case law, not Oregon case law, but case law around the country, and it's reminiscent of the old days in juvenile law. The court's motives, the motives of the people are all good. We want to do the right thing for these folks. So they don't need lawyers. We don't need to complicate this process. This is poor grandma needs to be protected, and we're going to do it. And she doesn't need to have anybody speak for her. That appears to be kind of the underlying current around the country in this regard. Thank you very much for
time. Who would like to go next?
I'll jump in. This is Fred Steele. I'm Fred Steele I am the state legal services developer, a position that is created and identified in the Older Americans Act. My position is housed in the Department of Human Services. And as Senator Dembro had spoken to when he started discussing this bill, I'm here in my role as kind of a co-lead, essentially, with a WINGS group. So that WINGS stands for Working Interdisciplinary interdisciplinary network of guardianship stakeholders. And this is a group that we formed and, again, co-led. So there's a couple probate judges here in Oregon that have been co-leading that effort with me to bring together about 35 stakeholders and partners here in Oregon from across the spectrum, you know, community, partners, providers, advocates, long-term care, long-term service supports, across the spectrum of persons with disabilities, developmental disabilities, our aging community, to look at guardianship issues, conservatorship issues. And that was kind of our starting point about a year and a half ago. But by the time we got to day two, realized that we're going to be looking at broader fiduciary relationships as well, powers of attorney, advance directives, and so on. You know, much of what we've done to date has been around prioritizing materials and training needs that will better support the infrastructure needs around guardianship and conservatorship. The reason I'm here and speaking and try to be a little briefer here going forward is that this WINGS group and our 35 stakeholders working on these issues and looking at these issues, you know, have identified, you know, legislative needs. And this issue is one of the priority areas that we've identified. So, again, we formed about a year and a half ago, starting at the heels of the Public Guardianship Conservatorship Task Force as it was completing its work, realizing a need and an opportunity to continue supporting that legislation, which this body passed last February and created, as Judge Welch spoken to. This is definitely one of those other and kind of next priority areas that we were looking at within our WINGS group. So we can't come out and say we support this bill as a, you know, just kind of a ad hoc collection of stakeholders working on these issues. But it is a priority area that we, you know, through a survey process we did internally with a number of partners around the state as well, realized that this is, you know, the need for legal counsel for these protected persons that are going in front of a court to have either some rights removed or all rights removed, that they should have that representation. So within that work, Senator Gelser, a couple questions that you were asking before, and I did see your legislation that was introduced. I saw that last week, looking at court visitors for persons that are individuals that are 16 and above and about to age into adulthood. And this is an issue that I've been learning about in the last year or so. My go-to person on that issue is Leslie Sutton at the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. She does a training trying to educate parents in particular that are confronted with this issue. It sounds like, as you were recently, looking at, you know, those decision-making opportunities for a child that needs some additional decision-making assistance, and whatever that level is, there is quite a spectrum depending on the individual. But when they turn 18, you know, maybe a guardianship conservatorship isn't the appropriate. Maybe it is other, you know, mechanisms, power of attorney, advance directive, healthcare representative. But it is something that has even come to me twice in the last 3 months. So I've received questions inside, you know, with my work with the WINGS work, people have recognized, you know, call Fred, maybe he has an answer. And I say, call Leslie, she has the answers. But it is something that I've recognized in the last few months, and I've talked to Leslie a couple times of realizing, well, there's more work to be done there. So I was very excited, actually, to see your legislation last week, and would be happy to talk to you about that and see if, you know, we can bring that to the WINGS group and support that, or, you know, have some discussions around that as you might envision. And then as far as specific to your question around supported decision making, we have actually looked at that through the WINGS, at least in one context, which is one of our first priority. We, you know, part of our WINGS group, we came together 35 stakeholders, but to do some substantive work, we broke up into work groups. One of those work groups is focused on the protected person and advocacy, essentially, for the protected person. And this that was kind of a brainchild of the entire group, but definitely our probate judge in Lane County wanted to see us do more work on the protected person, not just the infrastructure. And the product of that work group, which we just finalized here about 2 weeks ago, was a person-centered planning tool so that the newly appointed guardian, and primarily around the guardianship, but the guardian can sit down with the protected person and go through it's a three-page worksheet, and there's about 10 pages of kind of educational materials within that, somewhat of a manual. It's not comprehensive to guardianship, but to help that guardian understand their protected person and how to better understand what decisions that individual wants to make or would have made based on their values. And that's really what the importance is their values, not the values of the guardian. And I'd be happy to share that tool with you. Absolutely. So with that, I want to turn it over to Tammy Sims here, who's here, and I'll let her introduce herself, but she has a case that came to me as people, again, that guardianship issue, call Fred. And I started speaking to her last summer, and knowing that this bill was a possibility for this session, asked her to come testify on a case that really speaks to the need for this legislation. So if any further questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, turn it over.
Very great. Thank you. Is it Tammy?
Yes, thank you. Good morning. My name is Tammy Sims, and I'm an Adult Protective Service Specialist with Aging and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services in Coos County, way down south. And I'm here to share with you a case that had quite an impact on me, so I hope it shows the reason and the need for these changes with the guardianships and the conservatorships. I had the pleasure of meeting a middle-aged gentleman who had had a fall down a flight of stairs, resulting in a head injury and a settlement from that injury. At that time, the family was encouraged to obtain a conservator for those funds to ensure that they would be used for my client's benefit. They did so. They obtained a guardian, and initially a conservator, in the Portland area. The family met with the conservator. They were encouraged by what the conservator shared with them, and they determined that it would be an appropriate step. So around 2001, this conservator was appointed and started handling, at that point, just the settlement funds. Eventually, she ended up handling all of the Social Security and the pension, but initially it was for the settlement funds. And right after that was appointed, their issues started with the family. Everything was being questioned about the costs in the home, the vehicles that the client owned. Everything had gone from running smoothly to being quite a concern for everybody involved. And so we as APS, Adult Protective Services in the Coos County area, started getting a lot of calls around 2007 regarding this client, and all of these calls had some kind of financial exploitation component. We would investigate those allegations, and they were all unsubstantiated. But a common theme through all of those seemed to be the conservator. And we would make the suggestion to the client and the family that perhaps you should change the conservator if you're not happy with her. There are other options out there, and maybe you should address those. So finally, the conservator became such an issue in the client's life that in 2010, the client requested that a neighbor and a friend of his be his guardian. He was very concerned that he was going to be placed in some type of facility, which was one of his biggest fears. So the neighbor and the friend agreed. The client signed the documents, and he was appointed the guardian. So in February, we'll fast forward to February of 2014, where I actually received a call with concerns regarding the guardian. The conservator made contact with me and stated that she had concerns the guardian was not using the funds that were being sent to him for the client's well-being. So I started my investigation. The allegations of financial exploitation against the guardian were unsubstantiated, but there were several issues that were brought to my attention during that time frame. So in March of 2014, I sat down with the guardian, the client, and the family members, and every complaint and concern that was brought to me centered back on the conservator. The client refused to call the conservator any longer. He said that if he called up and asked for a $20 pair of shoes, by the time she billed for the phone call, it would cost over $50. So he just stopped contacting her. He felt it was a waste of his time and his money, and he just was not going to do it. What I found, though, was that I went to the home, to the client's home, and I found that his home was falling down around him. The siding was off the side of his home. You could actually see the insulation inside the home. That the skirting around his home had fallen down. There were animals living underneath his home. He didn't have lights in his kitchen because there was some electrical issue, and he would not address that. He would not call the conservator. We also found that this is a gentleman who, prior to this injury, was quite active in the community, and now he was isolated. His only interaction was a computer, and the computer had broken down, and when he requested to have that replaced, he was told there was the possibility that he could run up some type of bill on the internet by purchasing some item, and so the conservator didn't feel that that was in his best interest. His backup entertainment was a Nintendo set. His controller had broke, and he had been asking for quite some time to just get a controller so he would have that interaction. What I also found is that this gentleman was surviving on $340 per month. That money was to buy his cigarettes, his groceries, and his personal items. But when I reviewed the accountings that the conservator had, frequently the conservator was receiving way more than that each month in her own pay. So basically, the client was surviving on less than what the conservator was receiving from his resources every month. So at that point, I talked with our central office, and I said, what can we do? How can we help this man? Naively thinking that changing a conservatorship shouldn't be that difficult. He wasn't asking for it to be stopped. He wasn't asking for any change other than the person managing it. I was instructed to just have a local agency there, a nonprofit agency who did a great deal of conservatorships and actually had been in business for over 20 years, to see if they would take the conservatorship. They agreed. And so a local attorney assisted with filing the motions and the required documents to get that changed. Seemed pretty simple. It was in the best interest of the client. He would have had more interaction with a local conservator. The cost was less per month. And he would have had some say. He would have had some ability to direct some of what his funds were going to. The current conservator denied it, refused to change it, stated that there were family issues that the new conservator would not be aware of, and she didn't feel that it was in the best interest of the client, even though the guardian, the family, and the client all wanted it changed. Well, at that time, I said, logically, let's hire an attorney. Let's get you an attorney, and then, you know, they can fight for you. He had no access to his funds. He couldn't hire an attorney. Basically, at that point, the conservator had weaponized his money against him. She had access to those funds to fight his request, but the client had nothing, no ability to fund a legal battle. So fortunately, after begging a lot, the original attorney that had filed the original motion agreed to take this case on, knowing that he probably would not get compensated for it. He felt that the pride, dignity, and independence of this client was much more important than the fact that he may not get paid and may incur some costs. So after months of motions going back and forth and attorneys calling and talking, in August of 2014, we finally went to mediation. At the mediation, the current conservator finally resigned, but with the caveat that the guardian had to be reassigned to the same conservator, back to our local agency. And if you remember, what I said is that the client had picked the guardian because he trusted him and he believed that he would be in do what was in his best interest. And so this was very upsetting to my client, but he reluctantly agreed. He agreed because he wanted the conservator changed so drastically. So that was everything was agreed upon. We left there thinking this was going to be addressed, that his conservator was now going to be the local agency. Well, shortly after the agreement was signed in October 2014, my client died from cancer, brain cancer. The conservator did not sign the documents that were required. She delayed it. So as my client is laying on his deathbed, he's asking me, is the conservator changed? Has it been changed? And I lied to him, stating yes, it had, because it was so important to him. So he passed away believing it had been changed, but it actually had not. So now we have a conservator still in control of this client's estate. And now we have a family who now has to hire an attorney themselves to try to fight the current conservator who is trying to liquidate all of his estate. And they too do not have the funds available to be able to fight this. Now I'm a person, as an adult protective service specialist, that has often referred people to guardianships and conservatorships. We use that as a last option. We want to make sure that they stay as independent as possible. Safety and choice is quite important to us and to the client. And we do all we can to ensure it, but there are those select few that this is the only option that's available. In this case in particular, I felt that the client's dignity, self-respect, and independence was completely stripped from him. This was a man who'd had a very, very good life, had worked hard most of his life, and because of an injury, all of his rights were taken away. He had no ability to make any decisions. His biggest fear was losing his home, and he watched his home totally just be destroyed in front of him and having no ability to fix that. Thank goodness he had a very supportive family and he had a good guardian. The guardian and the family often paid for things for this client out of their own pocket. They did not receive a dime of compensation for any of it. So the person that was orchestrating this from out of the area received compensation, but the people doing the work didn't receive anything. And it got to the point where there was no communication between any of them. And it was in the best interest of the client to have him moved, have the conservatorship moved to a local area. And for whatever reason, I can only assume what that would be, the current conservator refused to do that. So this bill could have potentially saved him a lot of time and headaches and heartaches. If there was some way for a person that even once they have the guardianship and conservatorship appointed, who protects them? It's supposed to be the guardian and the conservator, but who makes sure that's being done? And who can represent them in a legal aspect? If in fact there's a change that needs to happen, they don't have the ability to go hire somebody. They don't have access to those funds. Legal aid, I beg legal aid to assist, but that's not their jurisdiction. That's not something they do. So what I'm asking is to please look not just once it's been appointed, but to try to figure out if somebody wants that changed, how do they go about that? If the conservator had to go to a court and ask for permission for those funds to be released so that she can use his funds to fight this, 9 times out of 10, in particular in this case, I don't think the judge would order that. Why would you want to order and spend the client's funds when it's in the best interest of the client? But because they have ultimate control, there's no way to dispute it. So I'm asking to look at the client's views and at the client's needs and wants. While I understand guardianships and conservatorships are required, I believe that there should not so much be limited, but I think that they should allow the client to be as independent as they possibly can be and to have the ability to make as many choices as they're capable of doing. There's different levels of incapacity, and I think that we need to look at what is a positive for them rather than what they can't do. And so I'm just asking you to look at it from a very dependent person's point of view and understand there are times that they want rights as well.
Thank you. Questions? I have one question. This really goes back to the original appointing of or hiring of the conservator in Portland. Was there not a conservatorship program in the sense of the referral was going to be back to the local area? I'm just curious as to why that wasn't the first option instead of having someone that was outside of their geographic area take that position.
I was not involved in the case at that time, but my understanding is the attorneys that represented my client were out of the area as well. And so they may not have been familiar with the local resources.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? I've asked, but I'll ask again, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 471? Not seeing anyone. Bob, guess what? This bill's not moving today. So I'm not sure what else you want to add, but it seems to me that you'll probably want to add more once we come back. Or do you want to do it now? Your choice. Okay.
Thank you, Senator Przanski. In my written testimony, the very last paragraph points out a slight technical issue. I just wanted to bring that to your attention, and that's the only reason for my testimony. I would just suggest adding two words, which are made or.
So that must be on OLIS.
Yeah.
What did you want to add? So we
the basic issue is that our guardianship law recognizes that particularly people who are incapacitated and don't have a lot of money are may need to orally inform the court that they have objections rather than file a legal motion like a lawyer would. And that is reflected throughout the ORS chapter. But in one section on line 15 of the printed bill, in Section 1, Subsection 4AB, it says when an objection is filed, certain things should happen. And I would think that in order to conform with the remainder of the chapter, that it should be when an objection is made or filed. It's a very technical, small issue that this committee might want to consider, or at least indicate that this section is intended to be consistent with the remainder of the chapter.
Okay.
And I haven't had an opportunity to talk with the proponents about that issue, but I certainly will.
That'd be great. Thank you. All right. Any questions based on that? Not seeing any. Thank you again.
Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 471. As we noted, we do not have all the documentation to move this bill forward. It looks like we need to maybe consider a couple other things. So with that, we will do that. Is there anything else that we need to take care of? Doesn't look like we do. We should be scheduled for tomorrow at 8:30, so we're adjourned for today. I don't want to talk about this one.